Little Bob here. It's America's 250th birthday, so shop the furniture America's waited 250 years for at Bob's Discount Furniture. We've got ultra-comfy power reclining sofas, stylish dining sets with convenient lift-top storage, best-selling bedrooms with over 700 five-star reviews, and a feature-packed pop-up sleeper sofa with built-in shelving and those signature Bob-a-pedic seats. So stop into Bob's Discount Furniture or shop online at mybobs.com, where America shops for furniture.
My sweet baby boys, I know that today you don't want to speak to me, have a relationship with me, or you may think you hate me, and that's okay. I will never be angry at you for your feelings.
That was Cori Richens addressing her children on May 13th. At a sentencing hearing. It was the first time any of us heard from Richens since the Utah mother of three was found guilty of aggravated murder in her husband Eric Richens' 2022 fentanyl overdose death. She was also found guilty of four other charges, including attempted aggravated murder, two counts of insurance fraud, and forgery.
And now I will use any opportunity I can to get a message to you. Even if that means sharing it publicly to the world, fully restrained, in my jail clothes, in one of the most horrible situations possible.
She was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Welcome to the season finale of Postmortem. I'm your host, 48 Hours correspondent Anne-Marie Green. And joining me today is 48 Hours correspondent Natalie Morales to discuss the dramatic conclusion of a case that has certainly gripped the nation. Natalie, welcome.
Thank you, Anne-Marie, for having me again. And boy, is this explosive, this sentencing hearing. We not only heard statements from Cori for the first time, but also from Eric's sisters, also from Eric and Cori's children in a statement, which you'll hear as read by their counselors. Now, this is a case, as you know, it's been getting a lot of media attention. We've reported on it extensively as well. We're going to break it all down for you today.
All right. So we are going to get into this. But first, a reminder, as usual, everyone, if you haven't watched or listened to this episode, it is called Cori Richens Behind the Facade. Go check it out now and then come on back for this conversation. And so, as you sort of point out, Natalie, a lot of people had been following this case, but it has gone on for quite a while. So why don't you give us a bit of a recap?
Well, let's go back to March of 2022. And, you know, Cori Richens at the time was 31 years old, Eric, 39 years old. They seemed to have it all by outward appearances. They seemed to be in a good marriage. They had three young sons. But it was in the early morning hours of March 4th, 2022, that Cori called 911. And she called and told the first responders that she had fallen asleep with one of the kids when she put him to bed. And then when she woke up, she went back to her bedroom and she found Eric cold to the touch and not breathing. So when the first responders arrived, they tried to save Eric, but it was already too late. Now, initially, authorities thought that Eric may have died from an accidental drug overdose. But as investigators dug deeper, they suspected that Cori poisoned Eric for financial gain.
So I think part of the reason why this case caught so many people's attention is because Richens notoriously published a children's book about grief. This is following her husband's death before being charged with murder, along with the insurance fraud charges and the forgery charges. But then in February of 2026, nearly 4 years after Eric's death, the trial finally begins in Utah in a courthouse there. What was the prosecution's case?
The prosecution alleged that Cori poisoned Eric with fentanyl that was served to him either in a Moscow Mule cocktail or a lemon drop shot, after apparently previously attempting to poison him via a breakfast sandwich. This was on Valentine's Day, which was 2 weeks earlier. The prosecution painted Cori as a killer who was set on taking her husband's money because she was deeply in debt with her house flipping business. And they pointed to the evidence that she was also the beneficiary of multiple life insurance policies on her husband and forged a policy as well. Now, the prosecution said that Eric Richens was considering divorcing his wife when he was killed, and that they had argued over this purchase of this multi-million dollar mansion that she was trying to flip for her real estate business. The prosecution also said that Corey was having an affair, and her former paramour, Josh more commonly Grossman, he actually testified to their relationship and the affair that they had during the trial. And the prosecution presented evidence that about 3 months before Eric's death, Corey had even gone so far as to book a Caribbean vacation for herself and for Grossman. Although it turns out they never ended up going on the trip because they broke up apparently after Eric died.
Huh. Okay. So then a lot of motive there. What about the defense? Right. What did the defense argue?
So the defense said Eric was dependent on drugs to deal with his chronic pain, and he had back issues apparently. And they maintained that he most likely died from an accidental overdose. Now, Corey's attorney said that Eric might have actually gotten the fentanyl himself when he had traveled to Mexico just a few weeks before he died. The defense also implied that he might have taken a marijuana gummy that he didn't know was laced with fentanyl. And it was really interesting and I think kind of shocking to the jurors, and you're going to hear from them in just a little bit. Mm-hmm. The defense made the decision not to call any witnesses, and Corey did not testify during the trial.
Why did the defense think that this was the best approach?
Many defense attorneys would advise their clients against testifying on their own behalf because it just opens themselves up to then being cross-examined and harshly generally cross-examined by the prosecution. And, you know, in fact, I asked Sky Lazaro, who was Corey's original defense attorney, about that. She made the point that if the defense also had called witnesses, the state then would have the opportunity to rebut the witnesses. Mm. And it's not the defense that has the burden of proof here. It is the prosecution. And Sky pointed out that the defense likely thought they were in a strong position. In fact, Greg Hall, who is Corey's really good friend and has been her supporter through all of this, he was there during a lot of the trial. Greg said that when the case wrapped, that the defense felt, and Corey in particular, felt really strong about their position. They felt like they were winning. So that's why he said he believes the defense decided not to call any witnesses and certainly would not put Corey on the stand.
Mm, well, I mean, their senses were off because the jury deliberated for about 3 hours before Correct. Returning the verdict, right? They found her guilty on all 5 counts, including aggravated murder, attempted murder, and 2 counts of insurance fraud and forgery. One of the things that is new in this episode is 48 Hours actually interviewed 2 of the jurors from the trial, Laura and Eric, and they requested that we only use their first names. But they gave us some insight into, you know, what the jury was considering, how they deliberated. What did they have to say?
They both said, Eric and Laura, that the minute the trial ended and they walked back into the deliberation room, they felt completely convinced of Corey's guilt, but they didn't know how the others felt yet. And Laura was the foreperson on the case. But she said she could just see that everybody was bursting at the seams to talk. They shared what they thought about the witnesses, the strengths, the weaknesses. But when they did take that vote, Laura said it was quick. I mean, deliberating for just 3 hours, it was pretty short, especially when you consider this is a murder charge and all these other charges as well.
Absolutely. What evidence was the most convincing for them?
So the juror, Eric, felt there were some inconsistencies with Corey's story and with what was actually presented as evidence. They pointed to her behavior right in the aftermath after discovering her husband was cold to the touch. They first talk about that 911 call, as well as the video that came from the responding officer's body cam. And they said it didn't seem like Corey was trying very hard to resuscitate him. Now, you can contrast that with these text messages that Corey exchanged with a friend, where Corey said that she was screaming, she was beating on Eric's chest, trying to get him to come back to life. They were also looking on the body cam footage of the responding officers to see how Corey was acting in those moments. And Corey is hiding her face a couple of times behind her hands. Like, you don't see tears. Laura, the juror, said it's difficult to judge how someone grieves or how somebody acts in a traumatic situation. But again, what was most impactful to Laura was the time that it took for Corey apparently to start the CPR. So the prosecution in its closing arguments actually had a stopwatch to show that it was approximately 6 minutes between when the 911 operator told Corey to start and when it appears that Corey on the other side of that call actually says she started.
Wow.
And the most convincing piece of that evidence came from the digital download expert who was able to analyze the phone data and determined that Corey did not put her phone on speakerphone, that she was still holding it up to her ear when she said she was doing CPR, which again should be done with both hands, suggesting she wasn't actually doing it or she was doing it one-handed, so not really giving it the full effort. Then beyond that, you know, Corey's money trouble really was the biggest motivating factor that they saw. That was the main motive that convinced them that Corey was responsible for Eric's murder.
Welcome back. So then 2 months after her conviction on what would have been Eric's 44th birthday, Corey Richens is back in court for sentencing. She's now convicted. She's in shackles. She's wearing a prison uniform. This sentencing hearing lasts nearly 5 hours. The judge allowed a lot of statements into the record, including Corey's three children, who are still quite young, 9, 11, and 13. They have prepared written statements that are read by counselors.
Right. And again, this is the first time that we're hearing from these three boys, the first time that they're expressing their feelings publicly. I want to play a few portions from that court hearing. Now, the first statement was written by the youngest of the boys, Weston. His counselor read his statement.
I feel a lot better about myself now than I did with Corey. I can't ever see my dad again. I want her to go to prison forever. If she got out, I would be so scared, really mad, and I wouldn't want to go with her anywhere.
I mean, it is heartbreaking. All of the three boys expressed feeling safer with Corey being locked up. The oldest explicitly asked the judge to give her that life sentence. So it gives you a sense of, you know, what has been lost in this relationship with her children.
So Ashton is Corey Richens' middle child, who accused Corey of not caring for him or his brothers, but he also accuses Corey of harming the pets. He referred to his brothers in the statement just by their initials. Let's listen to some portions of his statement read out loud by his counselor.
You took away my dad for no reason other than greed, and you only cared about yourself and your stupid boyfriends. You were not caring and watching over me and my brothers. I had to be a parent to W. C and I would walk him to the bus stop, feed him, and watch him. You wouldn't let our dog outside, and then the dog would pee inside. You created this problem, then you would smack my dog on the head as hard as you could. You wouldn't let me put my kitten in the garage for safety at night, and we found it eaten by raccoons the next day. You wouldn't let us turn on and use the heater lamp for the chickens and bunnies, and they froze to death.
This is kind of all new information, right? Was this sort of stuff brought up at the trial?
Nothing of this was brought up at the trial. What came into question was how she was as a wife, not as how she was as a mother.
These two children would have been quite young at the time when they were living with her.
Right.
Carter is the eldest son. And Carter says that Corey was often drunk, that that she would lock him in his room. Here's another counselor reading his statement.
I felt like I had to take care of my siblings. Ash mostly took care of me, though, because I was locked in my room. Ash would bring me food. Corey would lock me up if I told her she was drunk. This happened pretty much daily. I feel angry that she locked me in my room.
We should point out that about these statements, you know, they're not calling her mom. They're calling her Corey. But we don't know if prompts were given to the children to get those kinds of statements or what kinds of questions they were even asked by their counselors.
The court also heard from Katie, that is Eric's sister. I want to play some of that sound.
There is no question that this case is famous and that Corey is now famous. But what Corey never mentions in talking about her fame and notoriety are the reasons why this case is now famous. It is famous for how appalling and sickening it is. It is famous because a mother meticulously planned to kill her husband, killed him while their children were sleeping in the next room, and then had the audacity to hold herself out as the author of a children's book about grief and loss. It is famous because she spent time Googling luxury prisons for the rich in America. It is famous because from her jail cell, she scripted a bunch of phony testimony so that her brother could perpetrate a fraud on the court.
No love lost there.
Absolutely
right?
Not. I mean, she's not just angry about the loss of her brother, but she clearly is disgusted by Corey Richens and her character, the type of character she thinks she is. Eric has another sister. Her name is Amy. She also spoke.
I didn't just lose my brother. I lost my sister-in-law. I lost someone I considered my friend. We had good times together. That loss is so complicated now, Your Honor, because it forces you to grieve someone who is still alive while facing the horror of what they have done. It is grief that doesn't resolve. It just sits there heavy every day. This crime has fractured our family in ways outsiders cannot understand. Corey did not just kill Eric. She attempted to kill the spirit of everyone who loved him. She lied to his children, she lied to the world, and has shown no remorse while dancing on his grave for profit.
Amy, I think, is a little more retrospective in looking back on the relationship that she had with Corey and talking about that loss. Interesting to hear her say, I didn't just lose my brother, I lost my sister-in-law. I lost someone I considered my friend.
There were other people who spoke, though, on behalf of Corey, like her friend Greg, who described her as a loving mother who always went out of her way to help other people who were in need. And then her brother Ronnie said this, and as Ronnie was speaking, Corey was crying.
We don't with 100% certainty know what happened to Eric. No one does, but we do know with 100% certainty that it wasn't caused by you. We know that. The police know it, the prosecution knows it, and everyone watching this trial knows it. They could not prove their theory, just the opposite, and yet here we are. For some reason, unbeknownst to us, really bad things happen to really good people, Corin. You were just really too good of a person, I guess.
Very stark contrast to the other statements that we heard.
Yeah. I mean, one side paints her as just so heartless and so evil and so greedy. And here you have, you know, the other side is like, no, she was an incredible mother and an incredible friend and an incredible sibling.
Right. The too good of a person. You know, we did speak with Ronnie when we first reported on this case on 48 Hours, and he clearly believes in her innocence. And the same goes for Greg Hall, who I interviewed once again for this most recent hour. And they all feel that the jury missed the opportunity to get to know her.
And, you know, I mentioned that Corey had been crying when she was listening to her one brother there, but she had a lot of facial expressions during the sentencing hearing. She looked surprised. She looked incredulous. She wasn't stone-faced. Let's put it that way.
No, certainly not. I mean, the one thing that you could say about Corey, she was very expressive. She at one point appeared to be smirking. She rolled her eyes, it seemed, when Katie was speaking, Eric's sister. People look at that and mm-hmm. they will make judgments based on that. Of course, she's already been judged by the jury. They've already found her guilty, but now it's her sentencing hearing.
And then, of course, we heard from Corey Richens herself, and she spoke for about 30 minutes in a statement that was sort of a letter for her sons. She expressed, you know, regret for some of her behavior, but notably, she maintained her innocence, even apologizing to her sons for how the case unfolded. I'm going to play a clip of that.
I'm sorry that 8 people from a jury who have never met you or me or our family had the right to determine our future. And they did that in less than 3 hours. In a perfect world, there might be justice. But in a perfect world, nothing ever goes wrong. Tragedies don't happen. Some think a verdict or this sentencing will be the answer that they seek or that they need, but it won't. It will only give them something else to think about for a while. It may help to disperse some of their hurt or their resentment, but it won't relieve it. This grief will outlive us all.
What's so interesting of you know, what she said there, in my opinion, is she says, I'm so sorry for the jury's decision. I'm so mm-hmm. sorry the jury found me guilty. She said that her sons have the right to be angry, of course, sad and confused, and that, quote, one day when this is all over, we can sit down and talk about all of this and sort it all out. And she ended by saying she will continue to call her boys every day, even if her calls are blocked, and that she loves them forever because, you know, Corey has not had any real contact with the boys in all of these years since she was, awaiting trial.
So the judge is taking all of this in. And the judge sort of openly debates whether or not to sentence Corey Richens to 25 years to life or life without parole. He weighs the impact of the sentence on her 3 sons and really expresses a desire that everyone impacted by Eric's death find their way to a state of peace. Ultimately, the judge sentences Corey Richens to life without the possibility of parole. Natalie, is this the last we will hear from Corey Richens?
Probably not. According to her team, Corey plans to appeal the verdict, so this is going to keep going. But for the boys, I think, and for Eric's family, they feel that it's over mm-hmm. and they want it to be done with.
Mm-hmm. And do we have any idea how her sons are doing today?
Well, we know that they're living with Katie, that's Eric's sister, and her husband, Clint. They've really mm-hmm. Tried to keep them away from all of this attention. You know, now they've lost both parents and extended family as well. So the ripple effects of something like this will continue. And unfortunately, you know, it's the children who really pay the greatest price.
Absolutely. Well, Natalie, thank you so much for joining me today for Postmortem.
Good to talk about this with you again, Anne-Marie.
And thank you for listening to this season of Postmortem. Postmortem is hosted by me, Anne-Marie Green. Our producer is Annie Cronenberg. Kiara Norbitz is our coordinating producer. Jamie Benson is our senior director of podcast operations and production. Alan Peng is our podcast engineer and mixer. Alana Myers is our video editor. Special thanks to 48 Hours executive producer Judy Tigard, as well as Megan Marcus and Ainsley Rizzito. If you like this episode, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
It's always amazing to see how quickly your child grows, and I'm not just talking about their height. From those early babbles to full-on storytelling, getting to watch how their ideas, creativity, and confidence develop over the years is honestly pretty incredible. Sometimes they surprise you with what they come up with. And Lego bricks can be right there with them through all of those stages. It's not just a toy, it's a full creative building journey that keeps evolving as they do. Lego Sets Play starts as early as 1.5 with Lego Duplo, the bigger bricks designed for little hands that are just starting to explore and build. Then around age 4, kids transition to the smaller Lego bricks, and suddenly, you're watching real structures take shape, real ideas form, and their imagination really take off. They begin with simple stacking, but over time they grow into full-on creators, building worlds, stories, and things you never would have expected. That's the kind of magic of Lego bricks. You're not buying a phase, you're starting a journey. Learn more and start building today with Lego bricks.